This is a podcast from policyreview.tv.
Thank you, Geoffrey, and good morning, everyone. Today I'm wearing my Public Accounts Committee hat, and it's very timely that this conference should be held today, because at a minute past midnight, the Public Accounts Committee published our report here, which is now publicly available, and our conclusions and our recommendations from the NAO report. The NAO report to Parliament through the Public Accounts Committee, and we consider their documents and we take evidence on the contents. And so when the document was published by the NAO in June, we then held an evidence session in Parliament, and before us were the Permanent Secretary for the Department of Health, the Chief Accounting Officer in that department, the Director General for Social Care, Local Government and Care Partnerships, the Deputy Director for Special Educational Needs and Disability from the Department for Children, Schools and Families, and last but not least, the Deputy Director for Disability and Work from the Department of Work and Pensions. And you may know the reputation of the Public Accounts Committee. We take our work very seriously, and we do have the most senior civil servants appear before us. And when they answer the questions, we do try and make sure that we get the right answers to the questions. And if we don't, we ask them to come back again and try to have another go. So what I can tell you this morning is the conclusions now of the committee on which I serve. And we have put out a statement today, which I'd like to share part of it with you, and it's this: that adults with autism, particularly high-functioning autism, including Asperger syndrome, are often not diagnosed and supported appropriately. Many GPs and social care staff have little knowledge or awareness of the needs of people with autism, and there is a lack of local specialist support services. Adults with autism are being left to fend for themselves, with all the consequences this has for their access to further education, benefits or employment, and for their mental health. A critical point is the transition from the relatively structured framework of services for children to adulthood. It is like being cast adrift. This lamentable situation is down to a chronic lack of information about what happens to many over 16s with autism, as well as poor planning, sharing of data and coordination, and of working together between key individuals in health, social care, education and employment organisations. Now, you've heard about the Department of Health strategy, which we all very much welcome, which will be published by April of next year. And we too believe as a committee this is an excellent opportunity to set out how each of the recommendations by the National Audit Office and by the Public Accounts Committee is to be implemented and when. We like the detail in the Public Accounts Committee, and in fact we did get a commitment from each of the witnesses before our committee in June to say that they did agree that the recommendations of the National Audit Office were in tandem with what was being proposed with the national strategy. And so we shall expect to see that very clearly demonstrated when the Department of Health reports on its strategy, and it is published in detail. We had some specific conclusions and recommendations, and these are the recommendations of our committee. First of all, in that autism strategy, we believe that the National Audit Office should revisit the whole subject of autism, and in connection with the strategy, take another look at it in 2011 to review progress in the way the strategy by then is actually being implemented. So by then they will have published it, and we would have expected by then to be able to see tangible results in its implementation. In Parliament, and I expect many of you have the same experience, we receive many, many reports which have been well researched, which seem to show the way forward, but all too often they sit on a shelf somewhere and gather dust. That does not happen to National Audit Office reports with the Public Accounts Committee. So we are committed by 2011 to revisit this subject with the National Audit Office and to have tangible results put before us as to how implementation is showing progress on these matters. The next thing, which much of this has been touched on by previous speakers this morning, the next recommendation is that local organisations are not making collective use of existing information to plan and provide appropriate services for adults with autism and their carers. Carers very important in this whole debate. And to remedy this, we are recommending that NHS bodies and local authorities should collate local learning, disability and mental health data to identify and record all adults with autism known to the services. That should be an ongoing part of the work. That they should also use the joint strategic needs assessments, which Mark Lever mentioned, to identify the needs of adults with autism in their area and to make greater use of pooled budgets and joint commissioning to develop and deliver effective integrated services. And also that directors of children and adult services should work together using routine school census data to identify future demand for adult services from pupils with autism and special educational needs approaching the school leaving age. And could I just flag something up here? Statementing has changed over the years. We all know that. It is quite common, of course, even if somebody on the autistic spectrum is receiving support at school, they are not necessarily statemented. And when we get to this important transition period, the idea that we only collate information on children with statements of educational need, it has to go beyond that. It has to go beyond that. Or they fall down this black hole when they come out of full-time schooling. The third recommendation is to do with transition. And the transition from children to adult services needs to be managed effectively. Our committee did not think that it is being managed effectively. The Connection Service is supposed to support young people through transition, but as at December 2008, Connections did not know the training, employment or education status of 31% of their clients between 16 and 24 with a learning difficulty or a disability. Now that has to change because we rely so much on that service and they are, if you like, the gatekeepers to assist so much during that transition period. The Department for Children, Schools and Families should require the Connection Service to provide complete and comparable data from the client caseload information system and use this data to benchmark how well local services are supporting people with autism up to the age of 25. Including those not in education, employment or training. And we all know what that means when you delete people who are not in education, employment or training. All too many of them in their early 20s are sitting at home with mum and dad desperately trying to find things to occupy their day to keep their mental health stable. Connections should have an interest in that group as well as the ones that they are finding placements for. And the National Transition Support Team should use its local self-assessment work to identify and promote good practice in transition planning for young people with autism. Now, next, staff working in health, social care and benefits and employment services do not currently have the sufficient knowledge and awareness of autism. And this is all to do with training. And of course, it's quite varied and mixed. But again, we do believe that their local authorities should provide more autism training to the Connections personnel and advisers and to all staff carrying out community care assessments. And this comes down to something that comes up all too often, and that is a reason to exclude. And how easy it is to exclude people with Asperger syndrome or high-functioning autism when you're working along those tick boxes, and that gives you a reason to exclude. And if they are excluded, we all know what the consequences of that are, and I'll come on to that in a bit when we have something to say about diagnosis. The Department of Health should work with the Royal College of General Practitioners to develop autism content in the GP training curriculum, and most important this, and provide guidance to primary care trusts on how to improve knowledge of autism among existing GPs and primary care practitioners, because we know there is a little bit of a generation thing here. Now, we don't expect GPs to diagnose. We don't expect GPs to diagnose. We see them more as the gatekeepers, but we do expect GPs to have sufficient understanding of autism that they ask themselves, could this be autism? And if they think it might be autism, to make an appropriate referral to somebody who understands the condition. I think we all accept that this isn't a condition that you can just mug up in a theory in a book and have an understanding of it. So GPs have an important role here, but important from the NAO report that actually 80% of GPs said in the report that they needed more training to help manage their patient group who did present with autism and did have a diagnosis, because of course, like the rest of us, they go to the GP with flu and with other sorts of normal medical problems like anybody else, and the GPs do need to understand how they can support and also provide the basic primary care that they are entitled to as well as the rest of us. And the Department for Work and Pensions should provide autism awareness training to all disability employment advisors who have not yet received it, and make sure that all job centre staff are familiar with wider guidance on autism, developed in consultation with individuals and organisations with expertise on the condition. You know, I don't know how many times I have taken delegations to see DWP ministers. I have lost count over the years, including the excellent experts from organisations like the NAS, the Prospects team. I think the Prospects team have been on me twice. So I say to you, if you're from the DWP, we know you know. We know you know what needs to be done. And I'm not suggesting that you are necessarily just going to replicate the prospects system. But what you can extract from that and from other systems that work around the country, the exercise that BT has been carried out to positively employ people on the spectrum, there's enough data out there now and enough good practice not to have to spend another 5 years studying it and producing reports on what might be possible. It's possible now. It's possible now. And so we are very, very keen in our Public Accounts Committee that the DWP certainly rise to this challenge. Because the alternative is this, and many of us will have had personal experience with this, I certainly have. All these schemes to get people into work, great. And yes, of course, people need to be coached in job preparation and writing a CV and interview practice. But I know people on the autistic spectrum who've been around these courses like a revolving door 5 or 6 times. What they don't actually get is the hard bit at the end. How to find the job, how to apply for the job in terms of the interview, which is, of course, a very stressful situation. How to deal with job application forms which ask for references when you've never been in paid employment. And how to actually manage the whole process. You just need somebody to soften this all up with the prospective employer, possibly be sitting in the corner of the room at the interview. Yes, it's different, and you know, there are some big companies now where you apply, everything is online. You don't actually see or speak to a real person until well down the interview. But all of this can be overcome. So I just say, on behalf of the Public Accounts Committee, at the end of our evidence session, we felt the DWP could be doing a lot more, and that's why we've put that recommendation into our report today. Now, let's come on to diagnosis, because adults with high-functioning autism often fail to gain access to appropriate diagnosis and support because no specialist services exist locally. And the Department of Health should build on the financial modelling, which has been mentioned and so valuable that is there in the NAO report, to show local authorities and NHS bodies the costs and benefits of specialist diagnostic and support services for high-functioning autism. We know it's like an iceberg, you just see the tip of it, but it is lifelong. People who are born with autism die with autism. But what happens in between can make a difference, and the diagnosis is absolutely key to that. And Diagnosing adults is, of course, much more complex than diagnosing children, because adults who, as they come into adulthood, trying to cope with the world as they see it, means that very often they develop coping strategies. Some of those manifest themselves in what we might regard as strange behaviour. Sometimes they present with a mental health problem as well as the autism. And to have a specialist who can disaggregate what I would call normal autistic behaviour in crisis from something which is a genuine mental health condition with a diagnosis attached to it, you need someone with quite a bit of experience to be able to do that. The alternative, as we have seen only too often, is that if they are misdiagnosed, and the most common misdiagnosis is still schizophrenia, if you haven't got schizophrenia and you are medicated for it, and I have seen the casework where they go through one drug after another, and these are pretty powerful drugs we're talking about, by the time you get to drug 9, the brain is totally addled. And if it was heart surgery, or if it was a heart condition, and a cardiologist made a misdiagnosis like that and treated appropriately, you would be suing. There would be cases before the courts all over the country. There is absolutely no reason why people with autism should not have access to appropriate specialised diagnosis, whether they are children and particularly when they are adults, and that is there in our recommendations. Then out-of-area placements are not always based on appropriateness or clinical need and can divert resources which could be used to develop more cost-effective services locally. And local authorities and NHS bodies, we suggest, should review the appropriateness and cost-effectiveness of their long-term out-of-area placements. There will always be extremely complex clinical cases, some that border onto forensic cases. We all understand that we don't expect that to be provided in every borough. But there is a lot more that could be done a lot closer to home. And those, it's been touched on by others, that is one of our recommendations. And then the employment rates, which you've heard about. I've said a little bit about it before. The opportunity to work, and as we've heard, so many of them want to work. So many of them want to work. But we have to be flexible about this. For some people, and I find this particularly with people who have been able to engage in independent living, to sustain independent living skills sometimes is quite a challenge to somebody on the spectrum. So it won't always be appropriate to say, yes, they're going to work full time. They may well need to build up to it until you reach that tipping point where you know they can still cope with independent living skills and a paid job. That will be possible for many, not possible for everyone. But the system needs to be graded, and we need that expertise to go in there. And we need to, again, examine the feasibility of collecting routine data on whether applicants for Job Seekers Allowance and Employment and Support Allowance have a diagnosis of autism. Again, it's an area we know very little about because we don't collect the data. We also need to work more with employer organisations to raise awareness of the benefits of employing people with autism and the adjustment needed to support them. The benefits, we know, are many. Sometimes they need what I call a settling in period. Of course they do. They're surrounded by lots of people who they don't know. The social interaction is difficult. But very often, if you just stick with it, once they become familiar with their work environment, things slot into place. They're good timekeepers. They work hard. There's no reason why, given their qualifications, and of course we know they can go on to graduate and postgraduate qualifications, they shouldn't be doing the same work as everybody else that their qualifications and ability will allow them to do. But all too often I find a lot of people with autism who are in employment are so grateful for the job, but they're almost certainly in jobs where their skills would actually allow them to do something much more fulfilling that they actually trained for, but somehow they've been expected to take jobs which don't actually maximise that potential. And they deserve to be treated the same way as everybody else. And also, finally, in that recommendation under employment, in developing contractual and funding arrangements for future supported employment programmes, acknowledge the specialist knowledge, relatively long preparation times, and ongoing support required to produce successful job outcomes for people with autism. And I do think we have to get the message across. This doesn't mean that there needs to be a support worker sitting by that person to help them do the job. That isn't what we're talking about at all. People will get the jobs on their own merits and be able to actually do the job in hand. What the support work is for is to be there to troubleshoot and support. If there's a problem in the workplace, could be anything, I won't even go into it, you know there's a long list of things that could crop up as a problem. I just give you this one example. I know of one autistic man who only eats at certain times of day. In a workplace environment, if he's asked to go to lunch from 12 till 1, he will not eat because he doesn't eat till after 1 o'clock. May not be a big problem, you think, but actually, if the employer has somebody who can actually point this out to them, it shouldn't be too difficult to change when that person goes to lunch, because otherwise, by 3 or 4 o'clock, the anxiety is setting because they haven't eaten lunch. And it's simple little things like that. We're not talking about somebody standing there to check that they can do the work. They can do the work. There's no doubt about that. And then let me just come on to university students with autism. When we were preparing for the Autism Bill in Parliament, Cheryl Gillan, my colleague who brought this bill through the House of Commons, she drew number one in the private members' ballot, and bless her heart, she chose the autism bill of her, as her choice of bill to bring through. But we had some meetings with parents, with people with autism, as we were preparing for the bill. And I shall never forget this. We sat there in a room, and two parents talked to us about how difficult it had been to get their postgraduate son into employment. And the conversation went on for quite some time. And suddenly, Cheryl looked at the son who was in the room and said, "Oh, by the way, what is your degree in?" And he said, "Oh, I have a master's in astrophysics." Now, there is autism encapsulated in one sentence. Not everybody's got a master's in astrophysics who's on the autistic spectrum, but he had that degree, and yet the parents were still desperately trying to find employment for him because it wasn't something he could tackle on his own. It just sums it up, doesn't it? Now, the last thing that I want to raise, which is, University students, we think, our committee, that they need to use the Disabled Students Allowance, DSAs as they're called, to fund social rather than just course-related support. Because if academically they're capable of taking the degree, a lot of the problem, again, is around the social backup needed, very often living away from home for the first time in hall. That's a big challenge for somebody on the spectrum. And also the social integration with other students. So we need to be much more flexible to make sure that those who are capable of going to university can stay the course and can come away with the degree that they so rightly deserve and have worked for. And our final recommendation is that the Controller and Auditor General's report has identified the need for government departments to work together when supporting groups with specialised or complex needs. May I just say, I think that also needs to improve at a local level too, between health and social services. And it was very well explained by Amias Morse this morning. It's about this year's budget, not next year's budget. It's about whether it comes out of your budget and all the benefits are reaped by somebody else who has another budget. Somehow we've got to get out of these silos, and we as a committee believe that's absolutely imperative if we are to make progress in this area. So I hope you will read not only the NAO report but the Public Accounts Committee response to that, and I can assure you we will be back in 2011 and we will want to see progress. Thank you very much indeed.